From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two comics, one Egyptian-American, one Iranian-American, talk about how their jokes and their lives have changed since September 11th. Also, we talk with Shima Kirmani, a classical dancer in Pakistan, where public performances require a special government permit that is rarely given. She sees her dance as an artistic, sensual, and political statement. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from the Anglo-Punjabi band Corner Shop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court has ruled that it's unconstitutional to execute mentally retarded criminals. The ruling is drawing nationwide reaction. Shirley Jihad reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Writing for the majority, Justice John Paul Stevens says in recent years, more and more states have outlawed the execution of mentally disabled inmates, so it has become a cruel and unusual punishment. Stevens also writes mentally retarded defendants face a special risk of wrongful execution. In Illinois, several people on death row were later found innocent, so Illinois Governor George Ryan issued a moratorium on the death penalty. He says the high court's ruling is a good sign.
Well, I think it's long overdue. I mean, why would you put a mentally retarded person, why would you put a guy like that on death row? Even if they committed the crime, there are places those people can go.
30 states in the U.S. have prohibited the execution of mentally disabled people. For NPR News, I'm Shirley Jihad in Chicago.
Pilots at United Airlines have agreed to take substantial pay cuts as part of a financial recovery plan for the troubled air carrier. In exchange for accepting 10% pay cuts over the next 3 years, the pilots will receive stock options. The airline says the pilot wage cuts will save more than $500 million and help United qualify for federal loan guarantees. The company lost more than $2 billion last year, most of it during the drop-off in air travel after the September 11th attacks. Leaders of a congressional investigation of intelligence failures before September 11th say they've asked for an investigation of their own committees. The move comes after the White House accused lawmakers of leaking classified information. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Lawmakers investigating the CIA and the FBI now say they're willing to have the FBI investigate them. Congress has received masses of classified information from the agencies, and it's supposed to keep it secret. But yesterday, congressional sources revealed communications intercepted by the National Security Agency before September 11th. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says that Vice President Cheney called the committees to complain.
The president does have very deep concerns about anything that would be inappropriately leaked that could in any way endanger America's ability to gather intelligence information.
One senator, Richard Shelby, says he opposes leaks, but adds that he thinks most of them come from executive branch agencies themselves. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
A 60,000-acre wildfire in Arizona has driven about 4,000 people from their homes so far, and 14,000 others have been warned to be ready to evacuate if necessary. The so-called Rodeo Fire has already burned over the community of Pinedale, but the extent of the damage is not yet known. In stocks, the Dow lost 129 points, the Nasdaq lost 32 points. This is NPR News. A grand jury in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has indicted a retired Roman Catholic priest on charges of child rape and indecent assault. Prosecutors say the Reverend Paul Shanley molested four boys during the 1980s when he was a priest in the Boston suburb of Newton. Shanley, who's now 71, has pleaded not guilty. In World Cup soccer, attention is now shifting to tomorrow's quarterfinal matches. Traditional soccer powers Brazil and England meet in Japan, and the United States faces Germany in a game to be held in South Korea. Kayvon Antonio Hidari reports from Seoul.
The American World Cup team finalized preparations for their World Cup quarterfinal against Germany to be played in Ulsan. Before leaving their hotel in Seoul, the Americans said farewell to their families with the knowledge that they can make soccer history in South Korea. But the players such as Brad Friedel know the German team is tough to beat, whether they play well or not.
They probably think they should beat us. but deep down know that we can beat them. So it's going to be a very close contest.
Nonetheless, most experts thought the Americans would not make it out of the first round, much less to the quarterfinals. But in a World Cup full of surprises, the American team knows it can continue to impress the soccer world and an American public. For NPR News, I'm Kevan Antonio Haidari in Seoul.
The federal budget deficit rose sharply in May. The Treasury Department says the government outspent its revenue by more than $80 billion. So far, the total shortfall for the fiscal year that ends in September stands at $147 billion. Economists expect the government to post a deficit this year for the first time since 1997. They blame the recession, the war on terrorism, and tax cuts. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a time when Arab Americans and Muslim Americans fear they are being stereotyped, my two guests have to get on stage, win over an audience, and make them laugh. Ahmed Ahmed is an Egyptian-American comic. Maj Jobrani is Iranian-American. They're regulars at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles and are two of the four comics who have appeared in the Comedy Store series Arabian Nights. Jobrani and Ahmed also act. Jobrani has been featured in Malcolm in the Middle, Chicago Hope, and NYPD Blue, and is in the forthcoming Ice Cube movie Friday After Next. Ahmed has been in the movies Swingers and Executive Decision. I asked them if there was any material they had to throw out of their acts after September 11th. Let's start with Ahmed Ahmed's response.
Before September 11th, a lot of my material was talking about being Arab, but it was like, hey, I'm Arab, check me out. And after September 11th, it was sort of like, hey, I'm Arab, don't shoot.
Right.
So we did try to find ways to not necessarily talk about September 11th, but talk about the repercussions that, you know, ourselves and other Arabs, Persians and Muslims, you know, sort of suffered.
And I think also, this is Maz, before September 11th, Bush was an easy target. And then once September 11th hit, I hadn't voted for him. I'd voted for Gore. And I actually found myself being pro-Bush. And I think that, you know, it would have been comedy death to get up on stage the week after and say anything anti-Bush. And another thing I used to do was I used to make fun of, you know, Middle Easterners who pretended to be Italian, because I've had friends growing up who, you know, instead of being named Hossein or Farid or something, will change their names to Tony. And so I used to make fun of those guys. And then all of a sudden, once September 11th hit, the first show that I did was I was telling people that's how I dealt with the new changes. Is now when people come up to me and they ask me where am I from, I look them right in the eye and tell them, hey, I'm Italian.
I know for me personally, after September 11th, you know, because the hysteria over Arabs got way out of hand, you know, now when I get pulled over by the LAPD, I just tell them I'm black. Because I'm going to catch a beating one way or the other. And so I don't want to get killed too.
Ahmed, when it came time for you to sit down after September 11th and rewrite your act, like, where did you start? How did you go about doing it?
I went to the airport. I went right to the airport. I tried to get on a plane. And one of the jokes I do is I say, you know, I got to the baggage claim and I said, you know, the guy said, are these your bags, sir? I said, yes. He says, did you pack them yourself? I said, yes. And then they arrested me.
I'll tell you, Terry, what happened was, at first, I was thinking, what are we going to do? You know, we have to address it somehow. We have to. I mean, for me to get up on stage and do 20 minutes and say I'm from Iran and just say, you know, but what about traffic, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know, that's just me not addressing the issue I have to address. So at one point we realized that, hey, wait a minute, we can kind of help diffuse the situation by showing people that, hey, we're funny. We got a point of view. We have a sense of humor on the topic.
We're human, just like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
And trying to humanize it.
And we're scared in a lot of ways. I mean, like Ahmed was saying about his thing going to the airport. I actually, I mean, the first time I flew was several months after, And I was scared that I was they were going to, you know, stop me and say something. And I really, I found myself enunciating English like never before because I didn't want to have an accent.
Hello.
And I don't have an accent anyway, you know, but I was like, hello, my fellow American. I'm just trying to board the aeroplane, you know?
You know, Terry, I've flown to New York 3 times since September 11th, and I've been profiled every time. And granted, I'm wearing a full beard right now. I have a very, you know, sort of going for that Taliban look. This Time magazine said it's the look of the year, so I'm going to go for it. But they took my ID and it said Ahmed on it. They said, oh, your name matched one of the names of the terrorists. We have to do a profile on you. Sorry to inconvenience you. And I said, oh, that's okay. That's why I got here a month and a half early. But it's been that heightened security. There was a story where I said that there was this older white couple staring at me, you know, pointing the finger and whispering. And finally the husband walks over to me and taps me on the shoulder and he says, excuse me, just curious if you know how the weather is in Florida, because that's where my wife and I are flying. Where are you flying? And I looked at him and I said, I have a one-way ticket to paradise, my friend. And it was really just self-deprecating. You know, we were all trying to make light of it. They did it, you know. I went into a nightclub a week after September 11th, showed the woman my ID, and she read my name, looked at the picture, then looked at me, and her eyes popped out of her head out of fear. And I looked at her, and I said, you know, hey, I'm on your team, and I just want to come and celebrate and have a drink with my friends because I just graduated from flight school.
Hmm. Have you faced a new kind of heckling since September 11th?
I think that what we do that avoids too much heckling from happening is right off the bat we get up on stage and we make fun of the situation.
It's light. It's real light.
Again, like one of my jokes now that I lead off with is I say, it's not a good time to be from the Middle East because whenever I watch the news, this is how I see it. Good evening, this is CNN. Iranians suck. Back to you, Bob. So right off the bat, you know, from there, and then I go, you know, I turn to my dad. I say, hey, Dad, take off the turban, man. Put on a yarmulke or something. Better yet, Dad, here's a Raiders hat. You're a Raiders fan. Just go with it. And my dad's going, go Raiders. So right off the bat, I think what we do is by doing that joke is you establish the fact that, hey, man, I'm a little freaked out to be what I am these days. And then we can go on and make fun of other situations. And then if somebody in the crowd goes, you know, hey, towel head, you know, you look at them and you go, that's the best you can come up with. I just made fun of that. If we were up there saying something like, America, you know, you got what you had coming, you know, then, okay, now you're setting yourself up for a beating
Then we get a bottle thrown from the back of the room.
How do you, you know, that, and we're not doing that, you know. We that's one of the things that we try and do, too, is that to make people realize that we're not Middle Eastern comics. We're comics that happen to be Middle East, have a Middle Eastern background. And so, you know, we're American.
We're as white as they come, man.
You know?
I do a bit where I talk about how, you know, the type of women that I've been attracting these days. And the type of women that I've been attracting these days are women that want to rebel against their parents. Mm-hmm. It's always the girl, you know, who really wants to get back at her mom and dad. You know, she'll meet me and go home and call her friend. Stacy, it's me. Listen, I met this guy. He's tall, he's handsome, he's hairy, and here's the clincher, he's Arab. My parents would hate him, he's perfect. I think he's gay though, because he calls some guy named Allah 5 times a day.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Ahmed Ahmed and Maz Jobrani. They're 2 comics. Both are Arab-American. Ahmed Ahmed is of Egyptian descent. Maz Jobrani of Iranian descent. We're talking about how September 11th has affected their lives as comics. Let me ask you, like, when September 11th just happened and when you found out that it was, Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, what went through your mind about... what impact this was going to have on your world?
I was born and raised Muslim, and my parents were pretty, you know, strong practicing Muslims. They're not fundamentalists, obviously, but they definitely take the religion seriously. And I went on the pilgrimage to Mecca. I understand Islam pretty well to the way you're supposed to interpret it. So when this happened, I just thought, wow, like, it's going to be so much harder to sit there and explain my religion and my belief to people. So hopefully through comedy, you know, I can do that. I mean, there was such an impact on, like, what Muslims were about. And so it was, like, every Muslim's job to, like, explain themselves over and over. Hey, we're not terrorists. Hey, we're not trying to plot against America. Hey, you know, we're believers of God just like you. And for somebody like myself who was raised Muslim, you know, it's always has been and still will be a challenge to water down any sort of stereotype that the media, you know, has put on it.
And for me, Terry, first of all, just, you know, Iranians aren't actually Arab Americans. We're Middle Eastern Americans.
Right.
But
right.
Well, we
know,
both go.
Yeah, we both have the kh sound. Right, exactly. So we're both Americans. But yeah, we do have a lot in common. That's true. I'm not as religious as Ahmed. My family hasn't been religious. I think part of it for me has been the whole thing of the Iranian Revolution and how religion was used to kind of manipulate the revolution and the war and just the deaths that were caused after all that. You know, I think I just became kind of non-religious because just seeing how religion can be used for politics.
Yeah, it's hard to really practice a religion these days. In fact, I was talking about my mom, you know, is really, really like an advocate of me being married as soon as possible. I'm 31 years old, going on 32, and she's like, Ahmed, you really have to get married. You have to find a good Muslim woman. Find a good Muslim woman. And I'm like, Mom, I want to see what she looks like first, you know.
Right.
Because you never know.
There's www.muslimwomen.com.
In fact,
get on there and order a bride.
Yeah. In fact, I met a girl the other night who looked at me and she said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Egypt." She goes, "Ooh, you're Egyptian. How mysterious. Make me your Egyptian princess." So I threw a sheet over her head and I told her to be quiet.
Ahmed has strange encounters.
My guests are comics and actors Maaz Jobrani and Ahmed Ahmed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are two comics whose jokes and lives have changed since September 11th. Maaz Jobrani is Iranian-American. Ahmed Ahmed is Egyptian-American. Now, the impression I get is that for each of you, your parents emigrated to the United States, so they probably have accents. And
huge
also,
accents.
And also, they're not comics, so it's probably it's probably more difficult for them to diffuse any kind of hostility or stereotypes that they encounter.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if they've had a more difficult time than you've both had.
My mother, actually, it's funny because she told me she's the nicest lady, and she was at Costco. She was shopping, and she left her shopping cart for a minute, and she went, and she came back, and there was this old lady who was kind of just angry, and I think she had moved my mother's cart or something, or my mother had moved her cart when she'd been looking the other way because my mom was trying to get by, and the lady said, you know, who moved my cart? And my mother said, you know, I did, you know, I had to move it. And the lady just, you know, goes, you know, you shouldn't have done that. She says, well, I was trying to get through. And she goes, well, why don't you just go back home? And my mother said, lady, you go back home. And the lady said something else to my mother. Oh, she swore to my mother. She called her, you know, the B word. And my mother said, she who says it is it. And then, I grew up, I couldn't swear, you know. She who says it is it. And then as the lady's walking away, my mother goes, you old fart. And I mean, my mom never says anything. And here she was, you know, kind of being accosted by this lady. So yeah, the accent does add to that. And it also adds to the whole, I mean, from the beginning, you know, like you were saying, they come from another country. We come out here and we say we want to be comedians. Like, what, you know, what's that?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a clown? You know, yeah. What is, you know, my mom wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor, but once I became a comedian, her standards started going down. And now she just to have security in my life, based upon the last guy who came to our house to fix something. She'll recommend that as a career I should get into. You know, so you say, hi, Maz, how's comedy? Okay, have you thought about becoming a washing machine fixer guy? $75, 1.5 hour, that's not bad. It's a skill, you know. So that's where they're coming from.
Do your parents think your acts are funny?
My mom and dad, when I first started doing comedy, my mom would say, Ahmed, what are you talking about on stage? And I said, well, you know, I'm talking about you and dad and the family. Don't talk about your family on stage. And then finally they came out and saw me one night, and the room was quiet, and I was doing a joke about my father, and the audience laughed, and my dad stood up in the back of the room, and he says, remember where you came from. So now they're excited. Now they're okay with it. But in the beginning, they were like, don't talk about the family and mm-hmm. don't make fun of the family.
And my mom is a fan. I watch my own tapes a lot of times to kind of pick up pointers and fix jokes and the sort. And she'll be in the background, you know, just watching kind of quietly. And then I hear her laughing. And I think, you know, that whole thing of like, you know, how mothers never think their son is ugly no matter what, you know.
Yeah.
You know, she's laughing at jokes that I don't find
He's
that funny.
He's the most beautiful man in the whole world.
And she just laughs. And I go, hey, man, cool, I got a fan, you know. So she's been very supportive.
Now, you've both been in movies and on TV. Have you each played roles as terrorists?
Oh, yeah, imagine that. Mm-hmm. I was in a movie called Executive Decision with the Kurt Russell and Halle Berry and Steven Seagal, and I played terrorist number 4. And I didn't want to go in on the part because I was doing comedy at the time, and my agent said, just go in, it's a big movie, a lot of money, big stars, just go meet the director. So I went in and I read, and you know, I wasn't taking the part that seriously, I was just trying to be comedic about it mostly. So I read the lines just way over the top. And the director went ballistic. You know, my lines were like something like, sit down, you will obey, or I'll kill you in the name of Allah. And the director sat there, was quiet for a second, looked at me, and he goes, that was brilliant. Can you do it again? But this time, give me a little bit more of that Middle Eastern anger your people possess. So I used the anger that I had. And I got a call the next day from my agent, and they said they want to put you in this movie. And I said, are you kidding? I was just joking around. I was making fun of the role. She said, well, whatever you did, it worked, and they want to put you in this movie. I said, listen, thanks, but no thanks. I'm sick and tired of stereotyping these roles and, you know, my people, my culture, and I can't spit on my culture like this anymore. It's like feeding the beast. It's like putting fuel in the flame. No way.
So you did it.
Well, she says they want to pay you $50,000 for 3 weeks of work. So I said, flame on.
Yeah.
Let it burn.
Maz, I know that you've played a terrorist. What movie was it?
Yeah, I played a terrorist in a Chuck Norris movie that aired this year. And it came at a time when I'd had kind of a slow pilot season, and I was, you know, anxious to work. And so got the job and went down there And I honestly thought that, you know what, I'm going to put a human face to this character. I mean, the part was an Afghani terrorist who was trying to put a bomb together to blow up a building. It was kind of based on like an Al-Qaeda type thing, and it was done before September 11th. And I said, you know what, I'm going to try and humanize this guy. Like, why is this guy so angry? Why is this guy so anti-American?
Because he wants 72 virgins.
No, I honestly was trying to say, what was the background, you know? And so I gave him a background, all this stuff, and I went down there, and the character was supposed to have lived in America for 6 years and been going to the University of Chicago and, you know, just kind of blending in. And when I got there, they said, okay, you know, here's your turban. And I said, what? And I said, yeah, you got a turban. I said, you know what, I went to school at Berkeley. I know a lot of Muslim students, and they don't wear turbans. You know, they do blend in. And that became kind of a little point that we went back and forth on a few times. So, you know, cut to, you know, me with my turban. And I had, you know, you got to do what they say. But as comedians, this is the beauty of what we do. As comedians, you know, after the Chuck Norris thing, I had this thing going inside of me going, man, I did it. You know, I put on the turban and, God, you know, I kind of sold out. And so then, as a comedian, you go up on stage and you can make fun of it, you know?
That's your voice, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right, exactly.
And so now I got a joke based off of it where I say, yeah, I was in a Chuck Norris movie recently, you know, And as a Middle Eastern accent, as an actor, it's bittersweet getting a part in a Chuck Norris movie because you know you're going to die. And my agent called me up. You know, my agent called me up and he goes, "You got a movie?" I go, "Yes." And he goes, "With Chuck Norris." I'm like, "Damn." Because you know I'm not going to be his counterpart. It's not going to be Chuck and Hassan ever saving the world together, you know?
Well, let me ask you, you know, sometimes when people meet an actor who they don't know by name, they've seen him in like small character parts and they think they know them.
Right.
Or they think if the characters play a villain, that they really are a villain. Maybe that's why they know them. Maybe they were on the most wanted list or something.
Right.
So when people see you on the street or in a restaurant after seeing you in a role as a terrorist, does that kind of reinforce in their mind, like, oh, I think that's a terrorist?
I think, for me, whenever I rarely get recognized because my facial hair changes from, you know, day to day, month to month. I'm either wearing a full beard or I'm clean shaven or I'm wearing a goatee. But I'll see some, you know, I'll be waiting in line to get some food or at the grocery store, and I'll have people staring at me. And when somebody approaches me and says, were you in a movie where we broke a woman's neck? I'm like, yeah, that was me. Oh, man, it was so believable. I mean, really, you broke her neck really well, man. I really believed it. You
know? Yeah, and for me, too, I mean, I don't get recognized as much either. I think what happens is, you know, if I'm going on stage and somebody says, you know, he's been on Malcolm in the Middle and this and this and that, and then there's a Malcolm in the Middle fan that'll come over and go, hey, which episode were you in? I go, I was the guy that robbed. Oh, my God, I remember that was such a funny episode, that kind of a thing. And fortunately, you know, again, I think it kind of, that whole turban issue with the Chuck Norris movie actually worked in my advantage because I had the turban on, my character had glasses, so I think that helped kind of help me look different. And I also, I'm not sure how many viewers that movie had, so
right.
That's not a bad thing either.
You know, they did an article on us in the Wall Street Journal. It came out in December of last year. And they ended up putting my picture on the front page, which got a lot of attention, and I was excited. You know, the little suspect drawing they put on those pictures. So I ran home, and I showed my roommate. I said, hey, man, check this out. And he looked at the picture. He goes, oh, good, they got him. I said, hey, that's me, man. He says, oh, you mean I've been harboring you this whole time?
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
We'd love for you to come out to the Comedy Store one night.
Yeah, fly me out there.
Where are you exactly?
Philadelphia.
Are you in Philly?
Yeah.
We will fly you out, Terry. No problem. We will get a private plane for you.
I just got my flight license. Yeah.
Ahmed and Maz Jobrani are actors and comics who are regulars at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. And National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Hand Cream for a Generation, the new CD from Corner Shop, a British band led by an Indian singer-songwriter. Also, we talk with Shima Kirmani, a classical dancer in Pakistan, where public performances by women are more or less banned by the government. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shima Kermani, is a dancer who lives in Pakistan, where public performances by women are virtually banned. She performs classical Indian dance, which derives from Hindu traditions. She's one of the few classical dancers left in the country. Describing a rare public performance she gave in Karachi, New York Times reporter Seth Meidens wrote, "Vigorous, electrifying, sensual, a celebration of the body and its passions, her dance was everything conservative Muslim Pakistan now stands against." Earlier this week, she went to a studio in Karachi to talk with us about her dance and what it means to her artistically and politically. I asked her to explain the laws regulating dance in Pakistan.
Well, it was in 1983 that dancing on stage and television and all the state-owned media was banned by General ضیاء-الحق, dancing, classical dancing by women. And there was a law which said that anybody who wants to make a public performance of any kind needs to get an NOC. Now, this applied for not just dance, but for any kind of a public performance, whether it's theater or music concert or anything. So one actually needs an NOC, which is a no objection certificate. And this certificate is given by the state authorities. If it's a play, the script has to be censored. And then it goes to the commissioner's office. So that law still exists. Anytime I want a public performance of my dance or theater or any kind of a public performance, I still need to get that NOC. So the law has not changed, actually.
So do you apply for these no objection certificates when you dance?
Yes, sometimes one has to apply because in certain cases, the auditoriums, the halls, they need it as well. I mean, they will not give you a space unless you have that no objection certificate. But if it's a private performance, which means that you don't advertise it and you don't sell a ticket, then you don't need to apply for it.
Is that what you mostly do, private performances?
And so, yes. So generally, largely, dance performances in Karachi or in Pakistan, even today, would be private performances. And if they are not private, like I often do a lot of public performances, but then they are held at places like Alliance Française or, you know, the Goethe Institute. These places have diplomatic immunity, so they don't need an NOC.
Where does classical dancing by women fit in terms of how objectionable the government finds it?
Well, I think the Pakistani state has a little bit of a problem with classical dancing because they associate it with the Indian traditions, with the subcontinental traditions. And the problem is to sort of, you know, cut ourselves off from these so-called Indian traditions and evolve something which the state would like to call totally Pakistani, which doesn't happen generally. You don't evolve a culture just like that. It evolves over a period of time, and it evolves, comes through with traditions and customs, etc. So that has been a problem.
Is the classical dance seen as being more Hindu than Muslim?
I think so. Yes, that is one of the issues as well.
What about the dance itself? Is the dance meant to be sensual?
The dance is sensual. It is erotic at times as well. And at the same time, it can be very, it is very meaningful. It's very bold. It can say a lot. We see dancers in the subcontinent were actually storytelling. They were relating the histories of the people, the myths, because there was no written tradition of history. It was an oral tradition. So people used whatever at their means, and dance and, you know, movement and eye movement and hand gestures, which are very developed in our dance form. These were things that were used to pass down histories, to pass down legends. And so there's a lot, it's quite an intellectual thing.
Are you ever harassed or threatened in Pakistan because of your dancing?
Well, I have been often. But then a lot of women activists in this country are harassed who take a stand on issues like women's rights and things like that. So, yes, I have been harassed. I have been threatened.
By individuals or by the government?
No, the government would not give me that much lift. I mean, they just would like to ignore me. Individuals are more, I would more say, fundamentalist parties.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you react? What has the nature of the harassment been?
Well, threats, phone calls, letters, you know, threats to spaces where one is performing, halls, auditoriums, you know, those kind of things. But I do feel that a lot of it is just threats, which, well, up till now they haven't really followed it up, and one hopes that they won't, because it goes against them in a sense that, you know, because the general public, the general people are not going to sort of support something like this, where if somebody is performing and some fundamentalist group comes and blows it up or something. So it will go against them, but you never know. I mean, you know, there are fanatics all over the place.
Do you see your dance as a political statement? Like, when you dance, do you think of yourself as making a political statement as well as performing?
Yes, in a sense I do. I mean, I myself am a political person, and I feel that whatever I do has is a political statement, whether I'm dancing or I'm acting, because my whole ideology is brought into whatever I'm creating. And in the context here where, you know, it is almost looked on as a subversive act, whether I want it or not, it becomes political.
Now, your husband works in theater, too. Are the restrictions on men any different than the restrictions on women in performance?
Well, you see, the restrictions are on theater, on the restrictions on performance. I mean, in the whole city of Karachi, there's hardly a performance hall where one can perform. So it affects men as well as women. But the ban was actually for women dancing on stage, not for men dancing on stage. That is interesting.
Did you grow up in a religious Muslim family?
Yes.
And did your parents object to you dancing when you started to dance? Did they say anything wrong with it?
No, actually, my family was it is a very religious Muslim family, but they are a very liberal religious Muslim family. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, brought me to music and dance. They taught, as a child, I was learning dance and music and be involved in theater and things like that. So it's not that every Muslim family is conservative in the cultural sense. In fact, I think that generation of people they felt that art and culture is very important for education of the children. So, I mean, I've learned Western classical music for 8 to 10 years, and I started dancing when I was something like 9 years old. My mother sent me to learn dancing, and so it's not that my family has ever been against it at all.
Now, you've studied with some of the masters of classical Indian dance. Where did you go to study with them? Were they in Pakistan and India and other parts of the world?
Yes, I started learning dance in Karachi. For many years as a student, I was going to a place called the Rhythmic Arts Center, which was a kind of a center teaching dance and yoga and theater and a lot of classical music. And a lot of people used to come at that place. And I'm talking about the from 65 to the end 60s, actually. And then I went away to England to study art. I studied fine arts. I went to art college and I came back. Then I decided I wanted to take up dance much more seriously. And I went to India because that, you see, I mean, even my teachers here felt that if one wants to take up classical dancing seriously, one needs to go and learn it in India. So I went to India to learn classical dancing.
How did you discover the issue of women's rights?
Oh, I think started off from a very personal basis. So my brother is a year older than me, and I always felt that I have to do, that much better than him to get what I want. And so I was always competing with him as a child. I felt that if my parents are going to send him to university, I have to do 5 times better than him before they would think of sending me to university. So it started, I started feeling these things at a very young age, growing up as a sister in a house where the brother was just a year older than me.
It seems ironic to me that Pakistan has restricted many women's rights, but at the same time, it had a woman prime minister, Benazir Bhutto.
Yes, but Benazir Bhutto was... one thing that she didn't do was take away these anti-women laws, because she just also wanted to stay in power. I mean, so actually, at one point, she just became what all the other leaders become power hungry, basically, and so forgot what she should have done, because she had promised the women's groups here that she would take away all these anti-women laws, but she didn't. So yes, it is ironic, but she came into power more because of her, I would say, her father, the name that she carried, not because she was a woman.
Do you think it might ever get to the point in Pakistan where restrictions become so severe on what women can do or what dancers can do that you would feel forced to leave?
Well, I think in the last 25 years there have been times when one has thought that one can't continue and one must leave. But I've always felt that why should I leave? This is where I belong, this is where I'm born, and this is where I will die fighting it, because I feel what I'm doing is right and I will continue doing it till I really feel that nobody can actually stop me.
My guest is Shima Kermani, a traditional dancer who lives in Pakistan. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us from Karachi, Pakistan, is Shima Kermani. She's a classical dancer, but in Pakistan, public performances by women are virtually banned. Have you been worried about the possibility of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan?
Yes, yes. I have been involved in peace movements here, and I really feel that neither of these two countries should have ever got into nuclear armament and made the bomb or anything of the kind, and I think that no country at this point in the world, in this time of history, should be doing this, especially these countries where there's still so much to be done for the people, where there's still so much illiteracy, where health problems, unemployment, issues like that. And I mean, we're totally against this kind of a nuclear build-up. And yes, we have been worried about, because there is no way that they can control things once they let something start rolling. So, yes, I think we are very worried about this nuclear issue.
A lot of the foreign consulates, a lot of their people have left Pakistan because of the threat of nuclear war. Has that affected, has that affected you directly?
It's affected me directly in the sense that I have a lot of foreign students learning dance from me, so they've all left the country. That is how it's affected me. And also one's performances and travel abroad. I mean, all the consulates have closed. I had a performance in UK and I can't go because I can't get a visa. In that sense, yes.
Right. I want to ask you about music. We were talking about dance, but I imagine that music is very important to you as a dancer.
Yeah.
Do you have any problems listening to the music that you want to listen to? Problems in either playing it or even in finding it? Can you buy the recordings that you want in stores?
Well, actually, I would like to dance to live music. So I am always looking for musicians who can play the kind of music I want. And to buy recorded music is not a problem, or I can always get it from India or across the border. But what is a problem is finding musicians who would, sing or play music with you for a live performance. And that is what is much more exciting in dancing, to have a live performance. Musicians are dying. And there's as for dance, even music, it's not institutionalized, it's not looked after, so there's no, the old ustads did not teach their children. So it's a dying art form. I mean, these things, unfortunately, in Pakistan are all dying, I feel, dance and music and theater. And it's a big tragedy.
Do you think music in general is a dying art form or classical music?
Well, classical music, yes. Not music in general. There's a lot of pop music going on, but classical music is dying.
You're right across the border from India, which has a huge movie industry that's been nicknamed Bollywood. I wonder if those movies make it to Karachi, if you get to see a lot of those Indian musicals.
Oh, yes. There's a huge video market of Indian films. So one can just go and rent a video and see it at home. They're not in the cinema halls, of course, but you can see the latest Indian movie.
They're not in the movie theaters because...
Oh, because Indian films are banned in Pakistan.
Oh.
There's no trade between India and Pakistan, and right now there's nothing between India and Pakistan, not even travel or movement of any kind, as you know.
But you said you can get recordings that you want from India.
Well, till recently, I mean, I used to travel. I have been going to India almost every year to refresh myself, go back to my guru, go back to my teachers. So, but it's actually right now where there's so much tension between India and Pakistan. There's no movement, there's no traveling, there's nothing between India and Pakistan at the moment. In fact, there's all, as you know, there's total fear of war breaking out any minute. So right now this is the case, but we just hope that it's not going to last very long. But as far as dance is concerned, I'll go back to something that I think is an important thing that I'd like to add, and that is this whole issue of why I feel dance is important in our society, and not only as education for children, not only as something that will give them confidence and dignity and pride in their bodies, but specifically for women, I feel it's very important. It's important because, you see, here you have this whole culture of young girls, when they're growing up, they're told that they must hide their bodies, that they, you know, they, when they're sort of, you know, like developing breasts, you must not show your breasts and things like that. And so you grow up with a feeling of inferiority about your body. And I think dance combats that. It sort of gives you a feeling of dignity about your body, a feeling of confidence and pride in your body. You know, the minute you stand up straight with your spine straight and strength at the back of your spine, you feel strong. And I feel that's why it's important for women, for women's movement, to understand that dancing is so important.
You know how you're saying that dance, if you're standing up straight on stage and using your body in a strong way, it's very empowering. I'm wondering if you think that women who are forced to cover up and feel a little shameful about their bodies, if you notice that women's body postures are less straight and more kind of embarrassed looking, hunched up, exactly.
Oh yes, that is true. I mean, that's what I was saying, that young girls are constantly feeling that, oh, they must, you know, hunch their shoulders in and have their chest going in rather than out, so that their breasts don't show. And so there's a whole feeling of inferiority and a complex about the body, that you must not show it, you must hide it. And I think that is what the whole issue is about, that, you know, a dancer stands up on stage and says, well, I'm proud of my body, and I think it's a beautiful body, and I can show it to you. I don't have to hide it, you know. And that's what the fundamentalists are scared of, because it takes away their power.
Can I ask you where you're dancing next, or is that something that you're better off not sharing?
No. I have no problems about sharing. It's just too hot in Karachi at the moment. And so I'll wait for the summer to be over.
I see. Not a lot of air conditioning inside?
No, in spite of that, there's a lot of, it's very hot, and there's a lot of power breakdowns. So, and, you know, the city is really sizzling at the moment.
Right.
And summer is a bad time to be dancing. So, at least, I mean, for these 1 or 2 months, actually, there's hardly any dancing going on. In fact, I've even closed my classes because there's so much power failure, and one can't exercise in the heat.
Just one other question. The bombing of the American consulate in Pakistan made big news here in the United States. What impact did that have, like, in your community?
This incident has been very unfortunate, and I think everybody is very upset about it. And everybody is very upset. There were 5 young women who died in this bombing. And it's unfortunate that nobody is ever caught. People get away with this. And it's going to make it more and more difficult for us to do anything. I think, and especially for artists, you see, a lot of it depends, a lot of our work depends on how things are politically in the country. You can't have performances if there's this kind of thing going on. You can't even think of performing when this kind of thing is going on. People are dying around you. You can't, don't want to be dancing around. So it's really sad.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Okay, Terry. Goodbye.
Shima Kirmani is a classical dancer in Pakistan. She spoke to us from Karachi. Coming up, the international pop of Corner Shop, a British band led by Indian singer Jinder Singh. This is Fresh Air. Corner Shop is a British band led by the Indian singer-songwriter Jinder Singh. They've just released their first new album in 4 years. It's called Hand Cream for a Generation. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Corner Shop is still mining its synthesis of international pop styles, but with a new intensity and a new playfulness.
Behind the sound of Corner Shop, Jinder Singh is interested in grand, swirling masses of sound. Into this he incorporates, as he does on the song I just played, firm guitar lines, a catchy beat, and seemingly random touches such as a chorus of children's voices. He tops off this ice cream sundae of a song with the cherry of an elusive title, in this case, Staging the Plaguing of the Raised Platform. The result is transfixing stuff, and Corner Shop leaps genres constantly, relying on this mix and match method. We're gonna get on down now. We're gonna get on down. We're gonna get on down now. We're gonna get on down. Bust it. Pass me the laser beam. Check it out. And let me wipe the wretched out clean. Check it out. Pass me the laser beam. Check it out. And let me wipe the devil made clean. Streets a racket, got no time for the piper's row. Second round the corner, I let the Jackie Graham go. The windows up, I enter Soho Road. People by the pack is punctuated by the brown-eyed old broader than...
On that song, Wogs Will Walk, Jinder Singh condemns discrimination of the Indian population of England, while also taking advantage of the triple W's in the title to riff a little on the World Wide Web, as a uniting force in culture and politics. All the while, he maintains a groove that just won't quit.
1990 movement, to where we have come. 1990 movement, so many miles to be done. Well, we're going.
The English pop music press frequently refers to Corner Shop's music as Anglo-Punjabi rock, as good an abbreviation as any for these sinuous assemblages. The album's most ambitious chunk of music,
called Spectral Mornings, lasts nearly a quarter of an hour and features what we used to call a rave-up between corner shop sitar and the guitar playing of Noel Gallagher from the faded British pop group Oasis. Here's the start of it. Hard to do justice to the artful sprawl of this song, but I can suggest how it builds and unfolds by playing another section of Spectral Mornings. It's when the sitar begins to sound a little like one of Jimi Hendrix's psychedelic electric guitar improvisations, sliding into a good Grateful Dead jam. There is at once enormous ambition and cavalier wit suffusing all of Hand Cream for a Generation, beginning with its sampled advertising jingle of a title. At its best, the album suggests that Corner Shop wants to provide artistic provocation for a generation.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. And Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Fish, Blood, and Bone by Leslie Forbes, a tale of literary suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Barry Hanna on why he writes about violence and the presence of evil. His latest novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, is out in paperback. Also, John Powers reviews Steven Spielberg's new film, Minority Report. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.